Hi, and welcome to the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, and joining me is John. How are you, John?
I'm good. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, so this week we're going to be looking at the film 300, which just opened to a $70 million box office first weekend. Spectacular film. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was great, actually. I suppose, like everybody else, I woke up to kind of middling reviews, at least here in Los Angeles. I don't know how it was reviewed over on your side of the water, or even if it's opened yet, but... The critics, they didn't pan it, but they said it was kind of a triumph of style over substance. But I really enjoyed it, and clearly so did a lot of other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big problem sort of trying to, I guess, get in sync both critical acclaim and box office. And I'm sure some filmmakers would just prefer to make the box office. But, I mean, I think the film is really good. And apart from anything else, I like that any film that tries to do something a bit different tries to break out from behind being just a kind of formulistic thing. And certainly this, I mean, you know, there was Sin City, but this is a very stylized film.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think this film, I was aware, and I've been aware for some time, that there was a lot of buzz about the film kind of in and around the circles that you and I tend to associate with. But it wasn't clear to me just how much that was extending into the general public, and clearly, the public has been wanting to see this thing as well. I mean, I think what I read today is the biggest opening in March ever. It's kind of a perfect storm of situations. Yeah. So
certainly, I heard it was a very big opener for what I think in the US is an R-rated film. Is that right?
It is. It is R-rated, yeah.
Actually, I've got an invitation coming up to go to a pre-screening of the IMAX version of it. So.
Oh, that'll be impressive. Wow.
If the regular version was quite an assault on the senses, then this will be, I'm quite sure how I'll survive, really. tell me, what aspects kind of appeal to you? I guess let's start with the look. What did you think of the actual look, the grade, the actual sort of, you know, overall look of the film?
Gosh, I guess we could kind of start and almost finish there. I mean, there's lots of other things to talk about, but, you know, certainly the look is the first thing that strikes you, and one of the real strengths of the film, I think, is that it's pretty much consistent throughout. And I know that's probably partially because there's a kind of an interesting or unusual role for the art director on the show, but it's one of the things I was really drawn to is the way they kind of pulled off it, sort of, you know, something that was, I don't know, I guess you'd call it true to the tone of the book. I have the book around here. I remember reading it a few years ago, and at the time thinking, I wasn't actually thrilled by it. I'm a Frank Miller fan, but the book seemed a little bit distant and cool to me. But the film really kind of opened it all up and made it real. So I think that they had a name for that look, didn't they? I can't recall what it was.
It was literally called The Crush.
The Crush, okay.
And The Crush was something that was actually, because we got a chance over at fxguide.com to talk to, I don't know how common this is for you, but I mean, obviously there are visual effects supervisors on every film. We got to speak to the visual effects art director, Grant, and Grant is at Animal Logic, and he was working on the Matrix films and had a really long, extended role of playing this key part of being a visual effects art director. And got they were going to film the film in Australia at one stage, so he got involved. We went over to Los Angeles. It all moved to Canada. And so Animal Logic lent him to the production. So he was on from pre-production all the way through to the end. And he was telling us that, you know, The Crush was just trying to literally, as you say, match what was in the graphic novel, but not go as far as, say, Sin City, which I think is interesting, actually, because Sin City, for me, I'm one of the few people that just didn't love to death Sin City. I found it just too heavy going and too much like a live-action comic book. And so their decision not to go as completely black silhouetted and as completely graphic in this, I think, worked better. How would you compare those two looks between Sin City and this?
Well, I guess I'd have to agree. Yeah, there was a lot more of a comic book sensibility to Sin City, and I'm a fan of that film. I guess I was a fan of Sin City as well, so I guess my sensibilities roll that way. But I certainly like. I would call, even though that, you know, it's got the fantastical and the sort of mystical elements to it, the look of 300. I'd say they achieved a more naturalistic feel to it, a more organic feel to it, which I clearly referenced the original, you know, style of the art, but didn't didn't look comic booky to me, not really. And so on that level, I think it was very successful.
I mean, I really liked that look. I thought that if you're going to go for this graphic novel, that was the right balance between being very graphical and being so graphical that it was sort of absurd and remove me from the action. And I guess the interesting thing is, for ages we've had color correction in commercials, we've had, you know, highly stylized film clips, but it's really only the last few years that we're able to do highly stylized, highly DI'd features like this. And obviously some are going to work better than others, but I liked the look of this one.
The look is really good, and the way they integrate the look with some of the other techniques they use actually I think is very effective. Although, I'll pick a little bit of a nit here. I think it worked almost all the time, but I wish they'd been a little bit tighter on some of the, you know, some of their line work. There were a couple times when I thought, I'm looking at a comp, for some reason it doesn't really hold up, and I couldn't tell if it was a style choice or if it was just something that was a little rushed. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that was what they were trying to achieve. You know, I kept thinking again, and I've made this comment on past podcasts, that when I was working on The Frighteners, we used to joke about how many ills you could hide in a ghost's shadow glow effect. And I kept thinking, I shouldn't say cat. There were a couple of points in this film where I thought, well, you can get away with a lot if you've got a stylized look. You could argue that what's happening there on the edge there in the hair or something like that, it's just something that you were trying to do, as opposed to something that's a little bit weak in the work.
Yeah. I mean, I presume Weta had visual effects art directors.
Absolutely. And I think that I guess my sense of how that normally works is the art directors are typically attached to a facility, and not, I should say, VFX art directors are typically attached to a facility and not to a film. So I think it's a little unusual that they had an art director who was kind of managing the look overall, as opposed to the supervisor. But I think, you know, thinking about it, it's probably a way that it's going to work more and more in the future.
Well, I guess we should back up and point out, for those that don't know, that nearly the entire thing was shot on blue screen and not with much in the way of sets. So really a lot of the look and a lot of the art direction, the production design, did actually only sort of come real in post-production.
There were a lot of houses, right?
Oh, yeah. I believe that Hybrid was the lead house by shot count, but it wasn't one of those shows that had one house that was, you know, their film, and they farmed out a couple of, you know, bits to other people. So they did a lot of work. Animalogic did a bunch. Hydraulics. I'm going to miss somebody here, but there you go. Death Monkey. And there was somebody else.
It's like, Pixel Magic. Yeah, so there's multiple houses with more than 100 shots. Lots and lots and lots of work. Yeah.
I was going to ask you something else about that, because when we were talking to Grant Fregelin at in that role as visual art director, one of the things that he did straight off the bat was come up with that look of the blood splatters as like ink blobs. And I've heard people that have two minds of that. What did you think? Did you, because they obviously didn't want it to be 100% real looking blood, for both aesthetic reasons connected to the book, but also just so that thing didn't get like banned in 50 states.
I thought it was fine, actually. I thought it worked in the context of the film, and I didn't have any problems with it at all.
He apparently wanted to whip that up, and so of course ran around the house. And who these days actually has a container of ink? Right, I mean, I don't.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So he got balsamic vinegar and threw balsamic vinegar around on printer paper, and then scanned that in and mocked it up in After Effects, and that was pretty much the template that he then gave out in the in what they called the style guide to each of those VFX houses to actually come up with those various splatters and looks.
Right.
So tell me, just on the crush, I mean. The original colouring was actually by Lynn Varley, I believe, who did that, you know, reds and sort of bronze tones. I think it's a pretty nice look for, I mean, there was obviously a bunch of shots that were kind of blue as well. Uh-huh. But did you find it kind of grated on you after a while? I mean, after the initial kind of thing, or did you just sort of settle in and buy it?
I settled in and I bought it. And, you know, at one point I expected that the story was going to become a little tiresome, but I was pretty much transported by the film. Again, you know, that's why I said at the head of the show that I was kind of surprised at how much I enjoyed it. I was ready to become a little bit jaded by it, but I sort of bought into the entire sensibility. So I thought it all worked. I thought, I mean,
So
I thought
it's
there were some other choices. I mean, the Xerxes, I thought was a little heavily pierced, and there were some other artistic choices I would have questioned. But in terms of the look of the film, I think they did a great job.
One of the sequences that I think is kind of interesting, Screaming Death Monkey did the Oracle,
Gosh, she's
and
fantastic. Fantastic. Leaps out at you immediately.
I think it was shot underwater for those that haven't worked it out, and then there was smoke added. Though, interestingly, if I recall correctly, the smoke wasn't actually done as a smoke effect. I mean, it was 3D, but I think it was done as literally just an animated object, or it could have been done as fluid dynamics, but that was all added in. But it must have been a heck of a job, I reckon, keying that, because this was a fairly grainy film. It was a fairly high speed stock, so
Did they shoot their
I
own elements? I mean, I'm curious because when I was looking at the sequence, I was again, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's a woman who's partially clothed. So it's an attractive woman who's partially clothed, kind of writhing as she sort of tries to read the future. And I sort of picked it as water, although if you'd told me it wasn't water, I would have bought it. I would have thought, okay, well, that's clever, however they did it. But it looked incredibly smooth. You're right. The film itself is very grainy, but I would have bet that they shot that sequence on something else because it's nice. It's really smooth.
actually, I think not. I think it was
Really?
just hardcore. Yeah, apparently, like the it was just a hard key, hard work. They did nearly all their compositing on Digital Fusion, though they keyed that sequence in Inferno because it was hard work. And
And you're
I
saying
mean, it isn't
the
just
smoke wasn't practical, you're saying the smoke was actually CGI.
no, the smoke was CG,
Oh.
and the guys did a really good job. I think anyway, in integrating that. But I thought what was so interesting is that I hadn't realized this, but Screaming Death Monkeys, Jeremy Hunt, who was came to fame with the 405, the famous, infamous 405, the
Yes, of
start of the
course.
viral videos. So I guess that's one of my favorite scenes. I just like that. And
So, do those guys
did
in
you have a
Screaming Death
favorite?
Monkey do anything else? Did they any of the other sequences?
I believe that was their principal sequence. They did some other stuff, but that was by far their principal sequence.
Another one that I really liked was the there's a few shots in a sequence where some of the Persian ships are sort of being tossed about in a storm, and there was a kind of a painterly look to that I thought was pretty impressive. It kind of worked for me. It was all very sort of what's the word I'm looking for? I want to say painterly, but it was set up as a sort of a tableau. It wasn't realistic in any way. It was kind of hyper real, but it looked really cool.
What did you think of the digital animals, like elephants, rhinos, this sort of stuff?
I thought they were great. I thought they were great. I
Yeah.
mean, it seemed from the reporting that you did on FX Guide that they were almost kind of throwaways, like the first digital creatures done by the guys. It was Hydraulics, right?
Hydraulics did those two. Yeah, that I mentioned.
And great work. I mean, the you see a lot more of the elephants than you do of the rhinoceros, but I thought they worked fine. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean it's it's a combination of shaders and animation, because you really need to nail both of those things, and when you don't, when one of those two lets you down, it's horrendous. It can look great but not have weight, or it can look heavy and then look kind of plasticky, and I was I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I mean, the good news with the rhinoceros, I guess, if you're looking at it from a CG perspective, is that it's an armored rhinoceros, and you never get close enough to it to have to really analyze anything that's happening on the skin or anything like that. So there's a little bit of cheating that can go on there, but you're right. To actually get the heft and animation correct is difficult. And you do get a closer look at the elephants. I mean, they hold on that for a little bit, and so and they seem to hold up. I wasn't looking at it very hard, but it seemed fine to me. They seemed, like decent elephants right up to the point where they fall.
And of course, with your experience with crowd replication and huge armies and stuff, it seemed pretty seamless when we were moving from. I mean, I couldn't pick where we were moving from actors to CG extras. That was.
No, not at all. Although I think that they didn't. There weren't a lot of shots. There were a lot of shots that had a very wide perspective on a large host on the battlefield. But most of those seem to be distant shots. There wasn't a lot of mid. It seemed to me, looking back over the shots in the film in my mind, my mind's eye that there wasn't a lot of mid-ground stuff. You were either in close, fighting in close, in some amazing action sequences that we should talk about, or you were pulled out very wide, and there wasn't a lot of in-between work. Maybe I'm missing a shot.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it. I mean, there are obviously a huge number of things there that you go, okay, that had to be fake. I mean, there are large, you know, amounts of fake arrows and hacked off bits and stuff where you kind of in your head obviously know what's not. But you know, it's really a matter of does it pull you out of the film for me. I mean, I'm kind of loath to be in this school of stepping through things frame by frame and getting super picky, basically because I've done that with live action, and the live action can look pretty weird step through frame by frame.
True enough. But it's my job to pick nits, you know. I mean, I wouldn't get any satisfaction otherwise.
Totally. But you know what I mean? It's like my acid test is really I'm sitting in there and I'm either taken out of the picture or I'm not.
Yeah.
And occasionally something, you know, strikes me as either odds in the currency of what we're dealing with. I don't mind sort of where they take me as long as, A, they're consistent, and, B, it kind of works in their own logic. You know, I can accept that animals can talk if all the animals look realistically like they're talking and they're kind of consistent to that and it works. And in this, the same way. I mean, obviously there were some things that were in one sense preposterous, but in the stylized world that the film had set up for itself, it seemed to work. But let's talk about those action sequences. I'd love to hear your thoughts on those.
Fantastic stuff. I mean, it's really refreshing to me to see, you know, sort of extended battle choreography. I mean, we're talking about some very long shots and extended sequences of, you know, sword and spear fighting that feels fresh just because it's not, you know, straight out of Hong Kong. You know, I mean, we've been, I want to say subjected to, but, you know, we've enjoyed a lot of work, wire fighting, those kinds of things that have driven, you know, movies like The Matrix and any of it, you know, 50 or 60 others we could probably name. And this stuff kind of comes from a different school. And when you combine it with the camera technique, that sort of crash zooming in and out, you know, fast, slow, multiple angles, I thought it was very effective. I thought they were exciting to watch, interesting and cool.
I'll actually go so far as to say that some of the latter Matrix stuff, I almost got to the point where I was kind of yawning. It was almost like, yeah, you can do anything, you can survive anything, you can jump anywhere. And I didn't feel that with this, which was good. I think the other thing is we've really got to give credit to the editors, because I can't begin to imagine that was super tightly storyboarded. I mean, it was, but I'm betting that there was just a hell of a lot of really good editing going on in that to sort of maintain the logic of what was going on in a fight, so you weren't just sitting there going, I'm completely confused on who's hitting who.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. However, I will say that there was at least two specific sequences. I couldn't describe them to you. There's way too much action going on in them, where I thought, okay, I just saw, you know, one or two Spartans engage with 12 or 13 guys in a fairly stylistic, you know, manner, and there were no cuts. You know, the only cuts were the sort of smash in or out, the push in or out, and or changes from fast to slow that I believe were enabled by this camera technique, which maybe you can tell us a little bit more about. But that didn't appear to actually have an actual cut from camera to camera, or I should say possibly in this case from angle to angle. In the mix, and I was just incredibly impressed by it. I thought they probably had to do that particular take 30 times to get that choreography correct.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other people that deserve credit are the stunties, because I mean, we just assume with digital technology that it's relatively easy, but in nearly all these cases, there are some serious dedicated individuals being hurled around the place to get that in camera.
I think I read
close-up stuff.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that one sort of axiom or maxim that the director kind of was hewing to was that he wanted all of his actors to be interacting with real objects. You know, there was obviously there was going to be all this massive environmental enhancement and digital set extensions, but you know, there's no digital shields, and you know, they have actual spears in their hands. There's some spear tips that are replacing that sort of thing, but everything that they're actually interacting with, including each other, is all very real.
Well, actually, quite a lot of the actors had injuries from, you know, just the physicality of doing the performances.
I'm sure.
Many of them, you know, had, I'm not, you know, sort of critical injuries, of course, but you just can't get week in, week out through the amount of stuff they're doing. And, you know, yeah, I can imagine it would be a pretty grueling set to have been on.
Hmm.
It was all shot in Canada. And now, What was that you were alluding to with camera stuff? And I'm going to drop the ball here because I'm not sure what you were referring to then.
So the way that they were achieving the look, you know, they in some of the battle sequences when they're moving from you know, very high frame rates to very low frame rates to a very tight close up to a medium close up to a master shot in the battle sequence. They did that using a multiple camera setup, you know, three cameras overcranked at like 120 frames per second, all mounted on a single camera head, and shooting simultaneously. Right. So I think I read in one of your articles you talked briefly about that, right? That they were going to use a beam splitter, but they decided to use three cameras. I don't know what you can tell us about it. It was amazingly
effective. I don't have a lot of details on that. I thought it was interesting that it was all shot on film, and that they were using changing subject slightly. They were using blue screen, not green screen, because they just figured that the spill was, you know, most of it was against sky or whatever, and that was the way it was going to go in the grade. So they, you know, nearly always these days we hear people shooting green screen. This was nearly all blue, but. You know, I should do some more research because I didn't follow up on that stuff with the camera, and that would be interesting to follow up on.
You know, we're all sort of, all of us in the industry are aware of, you know, the tricks that were originally pioneered for the, you know, bullet time effects on the Matrix. You know, a row and array of cameras that are all shooting a frame simultaneously, so we can capture a moment in time and push around it. And these guys are doing kind of a subtly different version of that kind of thing to enable a different look, right? They had three cameras. They had one camera, and so they're in the same object. Let's call it Leonidas, you know, the warrior king, yep. The Spartans. They're shooting him with three cameras simultaneously, all cranking at 120 frames per second. And one of the cameras is pushed in very tight on his face. One of them is cut him in kind of a medium close-up, and what we'll call the sort of where the action's taking place in his fighting. And then the third camera is a master shot that shows him in the setting all around him. And so you've got, you know, as you're shooting the sequence, you've got all of this information, and they basically created a digital 3D environment to go behind all of the action. They compensated for all of the motion, you know, the offset between the three cameras, so that they all, you know, would appear to be aligned on the central camera, and then they'd use digital techniques to crash zoom between the different views to push in and out. So, you know, when you're moving from, you move very quickly from a medium close up to a wide shot. And what's actually happening is you're moving to the images that were captured by another camera. And at the same time, they're doing lots of things where they're slowing the action up or speeding or slowing the action down or speeding it up. And they're able to do that because they've been capturing at 120 frames per second. So there's just a lot of information for them to work with, you know, digitally to actually put that thing, all that thing together. It's an amazing effect. It's amazing. It looks really cool.
The DOP was Larry Fong, I believe. And It's great to see things evolve. Like, it's great to be kind of aware of techniques and then see somebody else take it and then push it in a new direction, take it to a new place.
It's one of those things that I think is gonna propel it to more money, because when I remember watching the action sequences and seeing how exciting they felt to me, and I thought, you know, if I was a 13, 14-year-old kid, I'd come back and see this movie again. If I could figure out a way to get past the R rating, if I could get past the person who's going to let me get in past the R rating again, this is exactly the kind of film that, you know, 20 years ago was what Hollywood wanted to make, which is, you know, the only way you get over $100 million is if you get the 13-year-old kids to go see a movie two or three times. This is that kind of movie.
Yeah. I mean, anything that's going to have this much opening is going to cause a spate of graphic novel, you know, graphical interpretation movies to come along. Let's hope they lift the game from this rather than just try and copy it and spin it out.
I think you're going to see that.
Hard to do.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's going to be very hard to do a 300 sequel.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say that. I don't think it's going to be long before we see somebody take this three camera technique and put it into use in some other fashion. I'm not really. And you know what? It's possible that this technique's already been used for a TV commercial or some other things. I know that the director has significant and serious chops in directing that kind of stuff in his past, so it could be that it's just something I haven't seen applied in that way in a film before, but it's very effective. And again, effective in that it works in the context of the film, the look of the film, you know, the subject matter of the film, and the performances are all very solid. You know, it's It's a nice piece of work. I'm glad they're making money with it.
Yeah, and shout out to Chris Watts, who was the visual effects supervisor. We haven't discussed Chris, but Chris did a lot of work with DI stuff from Pleasantville days, and clearly managing, that number of shots, which I think was up in the 1200 through
Right.
five or six facilities on this kind of intensity. He must have had his work cut out for him. So congratulations to him.
Yeah, so he's as one of the Pleasantville's guys, he'd be kind of on the cutting edge of the whole DI revolution. I was thinking about that a little bit earlier. Two things. I'd love to hear your input on the first. It struck me as I was going through the list of the houses that worked on the show and the technologies that they were used that it could be that one of the criteria for the selection of houses was the availability of discrete gear. Because and so I was wondering if you'd heard or you knew whether the crush, the look, was based on technology that was discrete technology. Or
No, I don't think it was actually. I don't think that that was a pivotal factor. Obviously, well, Hydraulics is a very discreet house as well. I was going to say discreet. It's actually Autodesk these days.
some
but
sorry sorry.
but no. But I mean, for example, we were talking about the Oracle scene. Apart from pulling some hard keys, all of that was done in Digital Fusion.
Right.
So I don't think that was a criteria. I think that there are, I mean, this film, interestingly, had the crush fairly early on, and so people were looking at things with a temporary LUT to have a that crush applied,
Right.
but I don't believe that they were delivering crushed scenes. Does that make sense? I don't think they were delivering
And
scenes that had already been through the crush. They were delivering stuff that was going to be crushed.
I understand. Okay, so it was applied in a very traditional DI way. It was a post process after all the effects were done, with the exception that the houses had a kind of a lookup table for their monitors, so they would know what was going to happen to their shots when they got crushed.
As I understand it, yeah, that's pretty much the case. And I know that there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing on some of these shots to get them to work. And they knew that that was going to be the case. That's why they'd done these style guides at the very beginning. They'd worked hard to try and give everybody a very accurate idea of where they were going with it. And you can see that actually. We've got a few on FX Guy, but you can see it if you look at the before panels. And then the after panels, just how closely things have actually, come through, given the constraints of live action versus illustration. And there was a huge amount of Photoshop work and stuff done, way before principal photography.
Right. The other thing that struck me, and I was thinking about as I walked out, was that inevitably, as you just made a reference to earlier, this is going to release a spate of films that are going to have these, this sort of DI look applied to them. Not necessarily that specific look, but people are going to say, "Oh, well, the kids want the crunchy DI looks, and we need to push our films around a bit more in a DI suite." And of course, there's already, a huge trend in the industry towards the application of DI in films. I mean, it turns up all over the place. Whether it's subtle or heavy, or particularly heavy-handed in the case of this film, it's happening all the time. But there's a real problem, I think. This is I'm we're drifting into my personal opinion, but there's a problem in that there's not nearly as many competent DI operators as the world seems to need right now. There's an awful lot of people with DI suites, but I can't tell you how many times I walk into a conversation with a bunch of people in a facility or industry, and they say, "Do you know any good DI operators?" And I always have to say, "Well, the only ones I know are they're busy making good money and probably not going to move."
Yeah, I mean, there's some great people at places like CSI or CIS, sorry, and places. But you're right, there aren't as many. You know what? I'm gonna predict that we're gonna look back on this period as the sort of MTVing of films, the time that films embraced the film clip look, and that pendulum's gonna swing too far. We're just gonna have a whole lot of heavy duty, stylized, very. And then there'll be a kind of it'll swing back and we'll get one of those movements like we had, like, I think about 10 years ago, where there was this whole thing about we're not going to shoot with artificial light and we're going to bank all pure and stuff. But I reckon we're in the middle or heading into the middle of the phase where it's going to be treating features like film clips, and there'll be, as you say, a huge spate of very stylized effects.
Right. So if you're a wannabe CG artist and looking for something to do with your future, you might want to start thinking about learning how to do DI, because for the next 3 or 4 years, it's going to be hot.
Yeah, and I mean, even if it's a film like Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever, I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be a superstar. I think it's going to have DI. It's going to
Yeah,
have
oh yeah, they're all
cameos
doing
and
it. They're all doing it. They're all doing it. Everybody's doing it.
so.
Yeah. And then you're teaching it, right? You're teaching that stuff.
We are actually over in FX PhD. Thanks for the
Yeah. No,
segue.
that's right. Yeah, we know you're doing it. Yeah.
We've got Lustre courses. We did Da Vinci 2K stuff last term, and we actually had a course this term on digital color theory, and that was phenomenally successful. And what we've discovered, and I think this is probably we've really hit on something here, is it's not just that people want to know how to use the tools; they want to understand the theory behind it. So, you know, it's one thing to say, well, you know, how do I do character modeling in Maya? It's another thing to say, oh, well, how do I design a character so it will work well for rigging and animating in Maya? Does that make sense? And
Right, absolutely.
what's the theory behind that? And I'm sort of breaking some million NDAs right now, whatever it is. But for example, I've stuck my neck out now.
No,
One of the
no,
courses we got.
pull your neck back in.
One of the courses we've got coming up, we've got this great concept artist, and so I always loved concept art, but I always imagined that the guys are like, you know, just draw these really cool pictures, and people go, wow, that's a really cool picture, you know, now we're gonna have to work out how to make it work. And this guy's phenomenal. He sits there and he's like, okay, do you want a quadruped or a biped? And you go, biped. And he's like, okay, so is it a carnivore or a herbivore, because that'll affect its eye position based on stereoscopic vision for hunting. And he just works through all the muscles, literally all the bones first, how the pivot of all the joints would work, and then up to the musculature, and then to the skinning, and then, you know, like things like stomachs and weight distribution and everything, based on environment, based on effectively the story. So by the time you come out with a character, it has a blueprint for being made in 3D, and it'll work because you know that you haven't sort of built this fantastic thing that would just topple over at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, it's based in a kind of reality, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're finding that that's what people really want. That the, as I said, like with the digital color theory, trying to understand some of the theories behind the color and how it's working, as opposed to just, you know, twiddle this knob to do this and twiddle this knob to do that. So, hey,
That's
what are you up
great.
to at the moment? We've just chatted what I'm up to. What are you up to at the moment?
those of you that have heard this podcast and multiple episodes will know that I've been threatening to do something in India for some time, and I'm still threatening to do
Excellent.
that.
And we look forward to the day that you can announce that and give us a blow by blow of what's actually happening. But
Yeah, or what actually happened. Yeah.
I jumped right in this week because I figured everyone was keen to get to the film. But if the people are still listening, we normally work out where you're calling from. I'm obviously in Sydney. Where are you at the moment? Are you
I'm in my classic, you know, ensconced to my home in Hermosa Beach. And we don't know where Alex is. I think Ron is in South America somewhere still. Yeah, and nobody really knows where Alex is.
Well, I was lucky enough to meet up with Alex in San Fran about a week or two ago, and we had sushi and got together and had a good chat, which is, and he is obviously incredibly busy, so I'm not sure where he is today, but hopefully he's well and caught on set somewhere. We're going to wrap it up for this week. Was there anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I'm done, mate.
I must admit, I've really enjoyed talking to you this week. Thanks, John.
As opposed to the earlier weeks where I'm just, you know, some.
Well, no, it's more like that, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that sometimes with the four of us, you know, I don't get
Yeah.
to talk to you so directly. It's
Right,
more, you
that's
know,
true. Yeah, we're all just kind of chiming in.
so for, you know, the glass is half full, I very much enjoyed having a chance to get more one-on-one with you this week. And obviously
Yeah.
next week we expect to be back to the usual crew. But the other thing we should plug, of course, is the new Pixel Core portal or website. The Pixel Core stuff was sitting as an offshoot from the Twit stuff and now has its own Pixel Core TV site. So you can go there, and that's where the forums are, that's where all the information is, and that is pixelcore.tv for those of you who haven't discovered it yet. Otherwise, of course, you can also get this stuff through iTunes, which presumably you did, otherwise you wouldn't be listening to it. That's pretty much it for me. I'm Mike Seymour in Sydney, and for you, John.
And I'm John Labrie in Hermosa Beach. We'll see you.
Okay, bye guys, thanks.